Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mikan Scott. I'm a little bit of a history geek. All right, I'm a major history geek. And there's a new museum opening up in Philadelphia, the Museum of the American Revolution. So I went to check it out. I got a sneak peek. And the big draw here is George Washington's tent. During the Revolutionary War, this roundish, family-sized white linen tent served as Washington's headquarters. It's where he slept, where big decisions were made. Imagine heated debates over strategies to beat the British, super secret meetings planning the Battle of Yorktown. And looking at it, just like every time I'm near an artifact like this, I got this feeling I can't really describe, but it's like, this is the real thing. This tent was there.
This is the reason why you can't experience the world through your iPad, even though I love my iPad and I love my couch, but actually being in the presence of these objects that were witnesses of these events. I mean, I can literally imagine that curtain wall being drawn back and seeing that Washington would have had to duck his head down to step outside of it.
That's Scott Stevenson. He's vice president of exhibits at the museum. He's been working to get this tent out of storage and on display for over 10 years. He calls it the first Oval Office. And before this fragile tent could be pitched, I mean, we're talking about 200-year-old fabric here, they made an exact replica of all of the pieces, and then they rehearsed the setup. Stevenson showed me a whole bunch of pictures of the copy. It was made in Colonial Williamsburg.
They hand-stitched that tent?
100% hand-stitched, yes. And then it involved the other trades, the joiners built. Those are, hand-turned mahogany tent poles, and the blacksmiths had to do the fittings. I mean, it was really a remarkable experience. Here it is actually set up on the grounds right outside Mount Vernon.
The replica looks amazing, but it still doesn't quite feel like the real thing, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's more of a provocation to want to see the original object. I mean, there is a power in objects that, I don't want to get too cosmic here, but you do feel like the history, the experience, the emotions almost do leave a kind of imprint in these objects that humans must be able to pick up on somehow.
I agree, we feel this strong connection that's just not there with a replica. So can a copy ever be as good as the original? We'll explore that on today's show. We'll hear about a machine that can mimic an organ, the quest to make delicious fake meat, and we'll find out what it's like to live on a Mars mock-up for 4 months. But our first story takes us to a nursing home. It's supposed to be just like home for the residents, but let's face it, no matter how fancy the place is, it never feels quite right. Is it the long, quiet hallways, the medical vibe, the smell of disinfectant everywhere? Some nursing homes try to cheer things up by bringing in pets, or, well, kind of pets. Elizabeth Fiedler has more.
Mark Lipsett goes to visit his partner, Mary, in a nursing home outside of Philadelphia, every day. It's a 40-minute drive. And to lighten her mood, he often brings along a meowing ball of orange and white fur, named Timmy.
Hey, Mary. Hi. Look what we brought. Mary, we brought a cat. Want to see the cat?
Lipsett puts the cat on Mary's lap. She's sitting in a wheelchair while a game show flashes on the TV next to her.
I'm going to put him on your lap, Mary. Hey, Mary. Mary. Mary, look.
Yes.
I'm right here, sweetheart. I'm right here.
Yes.
Okay, you got a kitty. Yeah, you got a kitty. See the kitty? See the kitty?
Mary has dementia, and her ability to communicate is limited. Sometimes she can answer yes or no questions. Other times, like this visit, she's closed to the world. She appears agitated and entirely uninterested in the cat. 4 years ago, when she was in her mid-50s, Mary started showing signs of a specific type of Alzheimer's disease.
Her memory wasn't really impacted at all, but it impacted her speech and her visual processing. It was hard for her to get in and out of a chair because the chair looked flat. It didn't have any dimension to it. It was very difficult. It was very frustrating.
Lipsett cared for her at home as long as he could. Then, about a year ago, she came to live here at the Abramson Center for Jewish Life. Lipsett hopes Timmy the cat reminds Mary of the beloved pet she once cared for.
Meow. Meow.
Do you hear that cat meowing? It sounds pretty real, but Timmy is a robot. That's right, not a real cat. So are the three owned by the nursing home. On a trip to visit residents, social worker Eileen Fridling carries along a gray and white one named Mittens.
I gotta make sure it's on. Is it on? No, let me put it on.
Fridling opens a Velcro tab on the cat's stomach and switches it on. Then she hands Mittens the cat to Lois, a resident in an orange shirt and glasses who's sitting in a wheelchair. Lois is a big fan of cats, even Mittens, who's sporting a red and green bow on his neck.
I'm 81 now, first time ever without an animal, and it's very empty. My animals always slept in the same bed as my husband and I, and it's just very lonely without an animal.
In the rec room where Lois is petting the robotic cat, there's also a cage full of tiny birds and another with a very furry bunny. While those living, breathing creatures require food, water, and upkeep, Mittens only needs batteries. And unlike therapy dogs that stop by for a short visit, the fake cats can work as many hours as needed, even at night. The robotic cat's thick pelt of fake fur is pleasant to pet, and its blinking eyes really do seem lifelike. But if you run your hand down the cat's back, its hard spine gives it away, as does the cat's inability to jump off your lap and stroll away. Lois says the robot doesn't completely fill the role of a real cat she once had.
When my cat had kittens, and she would get out of her box every once in a while to stroll around, my dog would jump into the box, lay down, and the kittens would snuggle with the dog.
Wow.
They were always, always
and what
friends.
What do you think of this cat?
She's beautiful. I never had a gray and white cat. Oh, the vibration from her, it feels so good. Love animals.
That soothing vibration is no coincidence. It's called Vibra-purr.
When it starts to purr, you actually feel that as you would a real cat.
That's Ted Fisher on the phone from Rhode Island. He's the vice president of business development at Hasbro, the toy company. For him, this is better than a real cat. He's actually allergic to them. Fisher says the company's engineers design the cats based on how real cats behave.
It will roll over at some point. There's 32 different sounds in the cat of purring and meowing. And it'll, you know, it sort of has this, it'll preen, sort of kind of cleaning itself, and really expressive eyes.
So are there health benefits to gazing into those expressive eyes? Research with senior citizens in New Zealand found that interactions with a robotic seal had similar benefits for older adults compared to time with a real animal. Another study found robotic dogs reduced feelings of loneliness among seniors at a long-term care facility. Back at the nursing home, just about every resident wants a look at the cat that social worker Eileen Fridling is carrying.
They definitely stop and chat and talk and want to hold the cat. It definitely makes people friendlier and more open.
Within the walls of a nursing home, where residents can struggle to feel at home, moments of joy and laughter can be significant. Fridling says the fake cats have helped some residents cope with specific reoccurring challenges, like the woman with dementia, whose growing agitation each evening has diminished now that she has a robotic cat to hold. The $99 cats, which come in three colors, aren't the only robotic animals out there. Hasbro also sells a dog. And remember that seal researchers studied interacting with senior citizens? The therapeutic robot named Pero is designed in the shape of a small seal and is used to calm people with dementia. Although maybe not everyone would find the sound relaxing. The seal is covered in different sensors. A light sensor perceives darkness. An audio sensor recognizes the direction of voice and words. Humans have been talking to robots for a long time, and sometimes they even change our behavior.
There was a chatbot back in the 60s that was named Eliza.
That's the self-described mistress of machines, Kate Darling. She studies human-robot interaction at MIT.
All it did was ask you questions when you said something. So you would say, I hate my mother, and it would say, why do you hate your mother? And people would completely open up to it and tell it all sorts of things, not realizing that, you know, this transcript was being recorded.
The ease with which humans connect with machines is no surprise to Darling. She paid a lot of attention to a child-sized robot named Hitchbot that journeyed down the East Coast from Massachusetts. Hitchbot didn't make it far. It was found decapitated in Philadelphia.
There was such a massive outpouring of sympathy and support from people who were sad about what had happened. And, you know, this arguably went beyond, you know, even what we would normally see for, you know, a human hitchhiker, let alone just someone's property that was vandalized in this case. So it really kind of illustrates the way that we will treat robots sort of like living things and have compassion for them, even though we know that they're just machines.
That point, that robots are just machines, may not be clear to some nursing home residents with dementia. And Darling admits,
in theory, I mean, I think there is something a little bit creepy, unethical about giving people the sense of nurturing something that's not alive.
But she says, from a practical perspective, you also have to look at what the alternatives are. If the choice is whether to give a patient more medication or to bring in a robotic cat to sit on her lap, Darling says she'd support using the robot. Mark Lipset, who bought one of the robotic cats for his partner Mary, isn't worried whether she understands that distinction.
The opportunity to have a pet, whether it's robotic or real, really I don't think makes a big difference. They feel the warmth, the security that they feel in petting it. I think it's very comforting.
Social workers at the nursing home in suburban Philadelphia agree. They're getting more cats and plan to start using them during end-of-life care. For The Pulse, I'm Elizabeth Fiedler.
I do not want a robotic cat, but I could go for a robot that maybe could clean my house or unload my dishwasher. But it turns out robots are not quite there yet. That's the sound of a robot struggling to pick up an object and actually dropping it. They miss a lot. Roboticists at Carnegie Mellon University say that picking things up is really hard. And now they are studying how babies learn how to do this. Hand-eye coordination. They are trying to copy the way infants learn, and they are also giving their machines more opportunities to interact with the world. One robot they have is getting thousands of hours of practice touching, prodding, lifting things, just like babies do. For the rest of this story from our partner station WESA in Pittsburgh, go to our website, whyy.org/thepulse. We're talking about copies on The Pulse today, wondering if a replica can ever be as good as the real thing. These days, when you record yourself, even just using your phone, it's high quality, and it should be a really decent copy of the real thing. But then when you listen to your voice in a recording, it tends to sound strange, right? As in, this is what I sound like? And then other people will say, no, yeah, that sounds like you. Why is that? I walk down the hall from my desk at WHYY to talk to somebody who hears recordings of her own voice all the time.
The first time I heard myself on the radio, I thought I would be ill. You know,
Yep, that is Terry Gross, host of Fresh Air.
It sounded so different than I thought I sounded. And it's not even that it was like better or worse. It was just so different. It was so disorienting. But at this point, I'm so used to hearing myself on tape and hearing myself in the real world that the difference between the two doesn't sound extreme to me anymore.
And when you first heard yourself, what was it different? How? You said it was shocking, but how so?
I think my voice sounded higher to me than I thought. I realized I talk really quickly. I still haven't solved that problem yet.
Did you ever have the thing where you hear yourself and you think, was that me or was that some, who's that?
Well, occasionally I'll hear myself. So to be honest, we have a speaker in the ladies' room. So HYY is always on in the ladies' room. So sometimes I'll walk in and I'll think, who's that? And I'll realize it's me. And other times I'll walk in and I'll think, oh, somebody's playing my tape, and I realize it's not me. But that's only for like the first couple of seconds, and then I realize who it actually is.
I always joke that at our work, we don't have driveway moments, we have bathroom moments.
Yes, that's right.
That's the only time we get to listen to the radio. Terry, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
So even Terry Gross thinks her voice sounds different in recordings, but how come? What's the science? I talked to William Hartman. He's part of the psychoacoustics group at Michigan State University. They apply physics to the psychology and physiology of hearing. And here's what he says happens when you listen to yourself as you talk.
The acoustical difference is primarily a boost in the low frequencies that you get when you listen to yourself. And other people don't get that. So the microphone that records you doesn't get that either. That's the difference.
And he told me that the boost in the low frequencies happens because of the way that sound travels inside of our bodies.
When you hear yourself, there's not only the acoustical pathway, but there's also the pathway through your own body, principally through the bones of your head. The acoustical pathway goes through your outer ear, your middle ear, and your inner ear in the way that sound normally does. The bone conduction pathway goes immediately to your inner ear. It vibrates the fluids of your inner ear. And that pathway does tend to emphasize lower frequencies, particularly the fundamental frequency of your voice.
So that's why our voices sound deeper to us in our own heads and higher in recordings. William Hartman is a professor of physics at Michigan State University. Vegetarian burgers look like burgers. I think they taste good if you're looking for mashed up vegetables and beans. But if you're craving a juicy burger, they don't cut it. A lot of people these days want to eat less meat for health reasons or to protect the environment. And reporter Andrew Stelzer says there are new guilt-free options without the meat.
This last few months, there's been quite a buzz in the San Francisco Bay Area about something called the Impossible Burger. Impossible because it tastes like meat, but it's not meat. I don't usually go to trendy, expensive foodie spots, but I had to taste this one for myself. Coxcomb is one of only six restaurants in the country that serves the Impossible Burger. I invited my friend Sarah along for the taste test. A meat-eating Jersey girl, she was kind of skeptical about the whole thing.
It's never going to taste as good as a juicy, juicy burger. I mean, think of all the burgers you've had in your life. Like, some places they grind a nice filet to make the patty meat. Yum.
One of the key ingredients in the burger is something called heme. Heme, like in hemoglobin, in our blood. Heme is a compound containing iron that's in most living plants and animals. It's also what makes meat sizzle and bleed. Impossible Foods derives heme from yeast through fermentation so that its burger sizzles and bleeds too. The theory is that red bloody drip is something meat eaters want, and it seems to be working. Coxcomb's maitre d' Stephen Oliver told me they've served 3,000 burgers since October, and 80% of people who come in for one are carnivores like me.
All right, little onions. I mean, it definitely looks like a burger. Let's see. The taste is pretty legit. I would say it's not as chewy.
There is some kind of red burger juice running down my chin.
All right.
Sarah's review.
Very tasty.
A?
Yeah, I'll give it A for taste.
I'll give it an A for taste.
Right, your
super good. What is it?
The burger is made from wheat, potatoes, and coconut oil, which must be why I'm licking my greasy lips. Plants that are higher in saturated fats are more likely to give your mouth a feeling similar to meat. The Impossible Burger is $19 here, including a small salad. That high price probably comes from the costs of engineering high-quality meatless meat. Creating and fine-tuning the burger took 2 years and was funded by almost $200 million from investors like Bill Gates and Google Ventures. Across the San Francisco Bay Bridge at the University of California at Berkeley, there's a classroom filled with students, all of them angling to be the next to break into the rapidly growing plant-based meat industry.
God, I can smell that chicken from over here.
Chef Dave Anderson is this week's guest lecturer. He's passing around two types of chicken strips, one real and another chickenless version made by a company he used to work for called Beyond Meat.
So here's the issue, right? Chicken has chicken flavor whether it has salt or not, right? But the process that these flavor companies are using to create chicken flavor produces a lot of salt too. So if you want to amp up the chicken flavor, you're taking a whole bunch of salt with it too.
The students try both versions.
And the flavor eraser wasn't there. It didn't taste a lot like chicken.
Oh, I love it. I am really struck by how it peels and how fibrous the mixture is.
At the end of the semester, the students with the best idea for a plant-based meat will get $5,000 and a meeting with venture capitalists. The students include food science, engineering, and business majors like Atisha Lewis.
What I've learned is just it does take a lot of upfront investment to get an extruder and get, you know, a team of scientists together who actually know how to mimic the flavor and the texture of meat.
Chef Anderson, who's spent the last 15 years designing meat alternatives, says much of the work is constantly tweaking a bunch of variables like taste, nutritional value, and cost.
We would have a meeting, oh, it needs more beef flavor, and so I'd crank up the beef flavor, and then the moisture would go to hell, and I would run the cost of it, and it would cost twice as much as it was supposed to. So it was this crazy balancing act.
For the moment, the Impossible Burger is the holy grail of meat substitutes. It's got the taste and the sustainability stats to boot. The Impossible Foods company says its burger uses a small fraction of the amount of land and water as cows raised for cattle and creates 87% less greenhouse gas emissions. Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, says what a lot of scientists are doing right now is trying to find plant proteins that can mimic the texture and qualities of animal proteins.
Meat is muscle, and muscle is designed to stretch and contract and designed to be very tough. And plants, on the other hand, are stationary. And so plant cells are designed to be sort of more like, you can think of them sort of more as like cinder blocks. They're very sturdy, but they're not very stretchy or very pliable.
Lopez-Alt says the fake meat industry is just getting started. He compared it to movie special effects in the 1980s, which were cool back then, but pretty lame compared to the 3D blockbusters we see on the big screen today. So hold on tight. That garden burger is only going to get better. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
We're talking about copies on the show today, and before that fake burger in Andrew's story, the Impossible Burger, hit the market, the people who created it in the lab had to be able to replicate their results over and over to make sure there was consistency in their product. And that's really true for any science experiment and for all scientific research.
If someone else goes and tries to do the same thing according to your methodology, they should be able to find something quite similar.
This is Ivan Oransky. He's a science writer and the co-founder of the website Retraction Watch.
The world is round no matter which way you measure it. And maybe you are off by 1 degree or you're off by a tiny bit of what the, say, circumference of the world is. Well, that's okay. It's all within range. But you shouldn't end up with one person finding that the world is flat, another person finding that the world is round, there's something dramatically wrong with at least one of those findings.
Oransky says as important as replication is in research, it doesn't happen enough, especially not with different teams of researchers trying to replicate each other's work. Sometimes that's because the scientists who did the original research didn't provide enough detail about their methods, how they got their results, but it goes beyond that. Do we have resources to replicate big, important studies, let's say, concerning a treatment or a cancer drug? I mean, I'm thinking studies cost a lot of money, and scientists might want to do their own thing rather than try to replicate somebody else's work.
Well, this is a key point, and it speaks to the real underlying problem, or one of the big underlying problems in science, which is the incentive structure. I am much more rewarded as a scientist if I go and do something new, that if I go and do something quote-unquote sexy that, you know, no one has ever seen before. If I spend all my time trying to replicate others' work, there's a chance that if I can show definitively that key ideas, that very well thought of ideas are wrong, I could actually probably make a career out of that. But that's not going to be a major force, a major driver in terms of competition, in terms of getting funding. And we in the past have called for actually explicitly funding, like earmarking, if you will, part of the NIH budget, National Institutes of Health budget, just for replication studies. We haven't seen that take off yet. But until we fund replications, this problem, it's hard to see how it's going to really be effectively solved.
Scientists recently tried to replicate 5 big cancer studies. What happened when they attempted that?
So in a sort of overly simplistic way, which is quite dangerous, to be honest, 2 of them did more or less replicate, meaning that the results were quite similar to what they would expect based on the previous results. 2 of them, they were outside of the range of what you would expect. And then one, it seems as though it really didn't replicate. But even there, you're talking about ranges. You're talking about some overlap of results in all of these cases and some unexpected results in all of these cases. So that's actually, although it's a small sample, there's only 5 studies there, is probably a good indicator of the sorts of challenges that we're going to find as scientists try to replicate.
So what does that mean for the original studies now, if they couldn't be replicated here?
You know, science is very much an incremental experience. It doesn't look that way from the outside because of the way that often the media reports on it or the way that scientists actually present it, as if things sort of move by leaps and bounds with a particular study. Most science is, you know, quite incremental. We learn a little bit. We sort of take one step forward or 2 steps forward and then a half step or a full step back. You know, there's a very famous quote by John Maddox, who was the editor of Nature magazine 20, 30 years ago, and a very prestigious journal. And a reporter once asked Maddox, well, how much of what you publish every week is wrong? And Maddox turned around and said, oh, that's an easy answer. Actually, everything in this journal is wrong. In other words, everything we publish is wrong. Now, did he mean that the minute it's published, it's wrong? No, what he meant was that over time, everything we know turns out to be, again, not completely wrong or not even wrong or false, but different from reality a little bit. It's different from what we would think of as absolute truth. So what anything means when you try and replicate a study or when you try and build on a study and you find something that is maybe a little bit different or even dramatically different, it's just that science is moving forward.
Ivan Oransky is a science writer and the co-founder of the website Retraction Watch. This is The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. We're talking about making copies on the show today and the quest to make a replica that's as good as the original or even better. Let's head to the ski slopes. But no, we're not going to talk about fake snow. A lot of skiers and snowboarders love to ride in uncharted territory outside of ski resorts. They go out of bounds in search of the real powdery, deep snow, but that can also put them in harm's way. I'm talking about avalanches. Researchers are studying the decisions skiers have made on mountaintops, the paths they have chosen, good and bad, in hopes of getting more people to replicate the smart choices. Marcy Krivenin reports.
Blaise Reardon was in his mid-30s when he was nearly buried in an avalanche. He was with three friends in Canada. They set out from a cabin, and the snow got deeper and visibility worse. Suddenly, an avalanche came barreling down.
You know, it was pretty terrifying, I think is, you know, really the only way to describe it. You know, just enough time to look up and see the snow coming, and then, you know, we're all tumbled and thrown down the slope. It definitely felt my skis pulling me under the snow till they came off.
One skier was partially buried, but amazingly, no one was hurt.
I actually don't like to talk about it, not because I'm embarrassed, but because I don't want the memory to get weakened. I'd like to keep it and make sure it keeps me out of trouble in the future.
Reardon admits he overlooked signs of danger. At one point, his ski pole pierced a hollow layer of weak snow. Many skiers fall into similar thinking traps, but scientists believe some mental pitfalls can be avoided. Today, Reardon is a safety instructor for the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. The center warns local residents about areas that are too dangerous to ski.
So I think Beaver Creek is right on the other side of this stuff.
Yeah, those up slopes.
So I haven't been up this side because I've looked.
He and a colleague are heading to the middle of nowhere to do some training. We turn onto a dirt road, and big peaks rise up in the distance.
Do you see avalanche terrain around us?
See the slope where it's really white there, and there's no brush? That slope has slid sometime this year. Those are steep slopes. They're generally shaded slopes that are going to have weaker snow, and they're big.
Forest Service workers from a nearby ranger station are the students.
So can everyone power up their beacons? Let me know if you're not sure how to do that. Check your battery power.
The students are holding what looks like small walkie-talkies.
Right, so
like Pac-Man.
The beacons talk to each other. If a skier gets buried under the snow, his device sends out a radio signal that tells the rescuers how close they are.
Is it a countdown?
No. Yeah, like when he gets close enough, it goes down to one. And the closer he gets,
the lower the number gets.
Correct.
Avalanches are triggered by people or weather. Wind, rain, snow, and sun can stress the snowpack to its breaking point, causing it to fracture and release. The National Snow and Ice Data Center says some avalanches travel up to 80 miles an hour, and a big slide can release enough snow to fill 20 football fields. Researchers at Montana State are trying to understand why people take mental shortcuts and put themselves in the path of that danger. Professor Jerry Johnson studies human judgment, and his team is collecting GPS data from the smartphones of skiers. The project is called TRAX.
The logic behind this is that your footprints are really a track of your decisions.
The data show a map of each skier's route and information about decisions made along the way. 4,000 reports or tracks have been submitted from users in 15 countries, in mountain ranges from the Tetons in Wyoming to Scandinavian peaks.
There's a group in Norway that is very active. They send us these very long tracks from the middle of December and January. They go out and do all of their backcountry skiing in the dark.
Just a handful of scientists are studying skier psychology in hopes of bringing down the death rate. The researchers in Montana aren't just studying the mistakes skiers make, but the successes and why people make it home safely.
By combining a couple methods, we think we have a pretty good, not only pathway, but sort of the psychic state of people.
Emotions can drive decision-making. After a big snow, a skier or snowboarder may ignore avalanche warning signs to get to untouched powder, like a sort of powder fever. Or people sometimes overlook danger if they've successfully skied the route before. Getting too caught up in the moment can be fatal. Safety instructor Blaise Reardon says after his close call with an avalanche in Canada, he now uses a checklist before he leaves the house to avoid emotional decision-making in the backcountry.
That's definitely an experience that's kind of shaped how I approach things, and just, you know, that awareness is really important. I don't want to die in an avalanche.
Back at the avalanche training, it's cold, but in the Central Rockies, you get used to deep snow and dressing warm. Everyone has on down coats, hats, gloves, snowshoes.
So now you've got your box, your probe.
Now your probe.
Student Jen Austin is poking at the deep snow with a long metal pole, hoping to uncover a cardboard box, the stand-in for a buried body.
I could definitely see how in a situation where someone's life is on the line, how this could be pretty intense.
Since the beginning of the ski season in December, 9 people have been killed in avalanches in the U.S. Most were skiers. I'm Marcy Krivenin for The Pulse.
Oh, we're punching right through the cardboard.
That would be right. Cardboard.
Okay.
Coming up, could a medical device mimic one of your organs? Stay tuned to The Pulse. Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY, offering clinically qualified cancer patients access to the American Society of Clinical Oncology's TAPER study on the effectiveness of new cancer drugs on specific tumor types. More at cancercenter.com. That's cancercenter.com. This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about copies on the show today, and in some cases, copies can replace the original. That's the hope for a new device that could replicate an important function of the pancreas. It could also revolutionize diabetes care, and that's something people who have this illness have been waiting for years. Here's Alan Yu with more.
Imagine you're at lunch at a Chipotle.
Two soft tacos with the barbacoa, please, for here.
Justin Wood can't eat that right away. He has to do something else before he takes a bite of his taco.
As I'm going to sit down and eat, I'll take my estimate of about 40 carbs, and I'm going to input it into the pump.
The pump is a medical device, about the size of a deck of cards. When he lifts his shirt, you can see a clear plastic tube leading from the pump directly into Justin's body. That tube sends the hormone insulin into the fat under his skin. After that, Justin can finally have lunch with his wife.
How's yours?
Good.
Insulin is a protein messenger that helps blood sugar move into cells so it can be used for energy. Normally, the pancreas, an organ just behind the stomach, makes insulin. But in Justin's case,
my body produces none.
Type 1 diabetes used to be called juvenile diabetes because most people are diagnosed when they're young. Justin was about 12 when he learned he has the disease. The condition is serious enough that he has the word diabetic tattooed on his left forearm in black capital letters. It's a warning to emergency personnel in case something goes wrong. One time, 15 years ago, he anticipated a carb-heavy meal with pasta and bread, and he gave himself a little extra insulin to break down all that food. But when the dinner was cancelled, and with not enough food in his system, his blood sugar dropped too low.
My roommate and my girlfriend at the time were feeding me candy and brownies, and they were getting me all kinds of food, and I still passed out.
To prevent this kind of thing, Justin checks his blood sugar regularly. That means he pricks his finger with a needle 6 to 8 times every day.
My fingers look like I have braille bits from the scabs and scars from checking my blood sugar all the time. There's small areas that just are darker.
But keeping blood sugar at healthy levels may get a bit easier for people like him with type 1 diabetes. Researchers have made an artificial pancreas.
Essentially a smart insulin pump.
Justin tried it out a few years ago. Researchers from the University of Virginia put him and some other patients in a hotel for about 2 days and watched.
So at one point, they simply put a meal in front of me and said, okay, go ahead and eat. Well, I haven't done that since I was 13 years old. It was a very strange moment for me.
For a while, he just looked at the plate of chicken and steamed vegetables and brown rice.
It took me about 10 minutes to work myself up to just eating.
The artificial pancreas measured his blood sugar levels as he ate and injected insulin as he needed it. Justin had gotten so used to having to do that himself, he was unnerved.
This was, you know, a positive situation that was kind of amusing in the discomfort it gave me, because it went against all of these habits that I have, you know, spent years developing to keep myself okay.
Researchers say the device could also be a relief for the parents of kids with diabetes. Stacy Anderson is with the Center for Diabetes Technology at the University of Virginia, and she's helping to develop the new artificial pancreas. Anderson says parents get nervous about their child's blood sugar dipping too low or spiking too high overnight.
People tell us they'll, you know, check the sugar before bed and then wake up religiously at 3 a.m. and check another sugar and then check one, you know, when they wake up in the morning.
The artificial pancreas is a pretty good copy of the organ inside the body, but it can't do everything. Anderson says people who use the device should still program insulin injections before each meal. But if the calculation is off, the artificial pancreas will help correct the dose after the meal. Justin Wood, the 45-year-old with the word diabetic tattooed on his arm, says the new technology could lighten the mental load of constantly thinking about his health.
It'll be an amazing bit of freedom for type 1 diabetics.
For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott, and our show today is about copies. So far, we've talked about replicating organs, robo-cats, we've tried fake meat that actually bleeds, and our last story takes us to another pretty far-out place, the barren top of a volcano. Way above the tree line, the surface is rocky, the earth is red. It almost looks like another planet. It's a volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii, and it's being used as a setting for a NASA-funded mission that explores what it's like to live on Mars. The name of the mission is High Seas. That stands for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. So what's it like to be part of that mission? Ross Lockwood was one of the people who was chosen to live on fake Mars in 2014, together with 5 other people. They spent 4 months in an inflatable dome about the size of a 2-bedroom apartment. Here's what he remembers from his experience.
We had 2 ways of describing our experience in the High Seas mission. We called things in-sim if we were living as if we were on Mars, and then we had out of sim when we were breaking the simulation, when we were doing something that wouldn't be possible on Mars. So my favorite in sim experience was definitely the spacewalking. We typically did 2 or 3 excursions a week for about 4 hours at a time, where we'd have to charge up the suits, make sure that their life support systems were working, dress in them, go through the airlock, and then finally go out exploring. Now, the suits themselves, as high fidelity as they were, they still used, you know, kind of conventional zippers. This is not a high-budget simulation. So once in a while, if we were bending over to pick up a rock or something interesting that we saw, the zipper would pop open. And that would be a case where we would then consider our actions out of sim, right? If that happened on Mars, you'd be sucked out the hole in the side of the suit. One frequent question that we get is whether or not our mission controllers supplied us with problems inside the habitat. And there's a very awesome quote that I repeat from the director of the mission. She says, they come up with their own problems. And that was totally true. On one particular fateful night, I got an email that said, please, you know, reboot one of our sensor connectors. And so I thought, well, this is innocuous. I'm just going to go and pull it out of its socket and then push it back in. And, you know, it should be very simple. Well, as soon as I pulled it out, all the lights in the habitat went down. In fact, every electrical system in the habitat went down. So now this is a situation where we're in sim still. This could happen on Mars. You could kill your habitat. But if it were really Mars, you'd probably have anywhere from 4 to 14 minutes to solve the problem. Without power, you know, your oxygen recyclers are offline. And so right away, the CO2 concentration in your habitat is going to start climbing up. And so we actually had to grab batteries out of our spacesuits and then jumpstart the whole habitat. And it really did feel like an Apollo 13 moment, because I'm standing there holding the wires of the battery ready to touch them on the contacts that I think will solve the problem. And the moment that I touch them, I see the sparks leap out and nothing happens. It's still dark. But then second by second, a fan starts whirring, a couple of LEDs flick on, and the system finally reboots and the power comes back. And it was just like the most kind of chest-clenching, heart-wrenching experience that you could have as the system specialist on a simulated Mars mission. One thing that was very clear to me from the get-go is just how much effort went into isolating the high seas habitat. Because at nighttime, when all of our systems were powered down, you know, you couldn't hear any human activity. There weren't planes flying over. There weren't cars driving on the roads. All you could hear was the breath of wind that was present there. So we really did get the sense of isolation. And with that came the feelings of loneliness. Not only were we isolated physically from the rest of the world, but even our internet connection was delayed by 40 minutes to simulate the speed of light round trip from Earth to Mars and back at its greatest distance. So we couldn't do things like face-to-face calls or audio calls. We would have to do everything through email, and all the responses coming back would take at minimum, you know, 40 minutes. I'm very glad that I participated in the high seas mission. My personal belief is that the human race needs to learn how to live in space in order to survive for another, let's say, 1,000 years. And I think it's important that we get our start on learning how to do that immediately. It's one of the few times in my life that I'm really going to be able to look back and say, hey, I contributed to human spaceflight. I contributed to, you know, human civilization expanding into the stars.
That's Ross Lockwood talking about his time on Fake Mars. The project is organized by the University of Hawaii and funded in part by NASA. And there is another similar mission going on right now that will last until August of 2017. Alex Stern produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. We had production assistance from Joel Wolfram this week. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, the associate producer. Tanya English, our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, our executive producer.
I'm Mike and Scott.
No, you're not. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. You're a copy. Poor Charlie.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Medicine's Heart and Vascular Center supports WHYY with over 20 community cardiology practices throughout Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Penn's Heart and Vascular Center has made a commitment to deliver advanced treatment options, personalized care, and convenient access close to home. Learn more about Penn's Heart and Vascular Center at pennheart.org or 800-789-PENN. Your life is worth Penn Medicine.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.